By the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2005 lecture series presents Iraq, From Sanctions to Occupation and Resistance by Tariq Ali, writer, journalist, and filmmaker, on Thursday, October 21st at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium, Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming family audiences for the folkloric Virsky Ukrainian National Dance Company, and a free Arts for Kids presentation by the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In our first hour today, we'll be talking with Alexander Heyman. He's a writer. He now makes his home in the United States, in Chicago, but he was born in Bosnia, in the city of Sarajevo. He came to the United States in the early 90s on an exchange program. He was trained as a journalist and did that, and also did fiction writing there at home. He ended up staying here in the United States because war broke out at home. He had a series of jobs. He was a bike messenger. He worked in a bookstore. He taught English as a second language. And also in the mid-90s, he began to write in English, his second language. His stories got some positive attention. Some were published. His first book was a collection of stories titled The Question of Bruno. And then that was followed a few years later by his first novel, Nowhere Man. He's published in The New Yorker, Esquire, Granta, The Paris Review. He recently was named a MacArthur Fellow. At the moment, he's visiting professor in the graduate program in creative writing here at the U of I, spending this semester there. And in fact, today we'll be giving a reading on the campus at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4:30 this afternoon in the Author's Corner. So if you're interested in meeting him and hearing some more from him, you can stop by there. And, of course, questions are welcome. Anybody would like to call in, you can do that, too. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me here.
When you first came here on this exchange program, how long were you supposed to stay? What was the original plan?
I was participating in something called the International Visitors Program under the auspices of the United States Information Agency, and that's that's what I was sold, a month-long trip, a very comfortable and pleasant trip where you're taken around the United States at their expense and shown the wonders of democracy and capitalism. But then I stayed over for another month or so to visit some friends. I visited a friend in Canada and then came to Chicago to visit a friend whom I had met in the summer of 91 in Ukraine.
Then what were the circumstances that led to your staying here?
Well, I left Sarajevo in January of 92, the end of January. And then in the spring, early spring in March and April of 92, although there had already been fighting in Croatia, which is very close to Bosnia, obviously. There were no armed conflicts in Bosnia when I left, but in the early spring of 92, the fighting had started. So by the time I reached Chicago, they were shooting in Sarajevo and all over Bosnia. I was supposed to go back on May 1st of 92, and which means I would have arrived on May 2nd of 92, and that happens to be the date, in fact, when the siege of Sarajevo closed. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those eerie coincidences that had I gone back, I would have arrived just in time to be under siege with the rest of the city.
Mm. So what was behind your decision not to? Were you just thinking at the time, well, you'd stay for a little while? It was not in your mind that you were going to.
Well, no, I thought I would stay if someone offered me a very well-paid job, which is what people do in the United States to foreigners all the time. Why don't you come over and teach for $1 million? There was an astronomical possibility, I guess, for me to stay under different circumstances. And I didn't really want to stay, as, you know, appealing as the United States is. I loved Sarajevo. I still do. I want to stay there. And, of course, on the one hand, I rationally knew that the war was coming up. On the other hand, I simply could not accept this fact. In some ways, people have a psychological block which prevents them from imagining the demise of their own life. Otherwise, that life would be impossible. If you were able to imagine the moment of your death, you wouldn't be able to live. And this works on the collective level, as it were. I had all the information, because I used to work in journalism, that one needed to understand what was going to happen, and yet none of us could really accept this, except the people who were actually planning this, the Serbian Nationalist Party, predominantly.
So when you were living in Bosnia, you were working as a journalist. Did you also write fiction?
Well, I was working as a journalist because I needed an outlet for my writing. I have always really thought of myself as a writer, not really professionally speaking, but I want to write fiction. I wanted to work in literature rather than journalism. But for a number of reasons, the most natural and immediate outlet was the media, were the media in Bosnia at the time. One of the reasons was that things were changing so rapidly that to write a book over time and then wait for it to get published, assuming that anyone would want to publish a book by someone who's in their early 20s, you know, that's a couple of years right there. Whereas things were changing so rapidly, things were falling apart at the same time. And at the same time, we had a sense, people of my generation, that there were possibilities opening up for us, because in some ways the late 80s and early 90s in Bosnia for people of my generation was this, it was a, those years were a small window between communism and nationalism. We thought that the possibility of a civic society was within reach, or a civic society is something that it was worth fighting for. It was also the kind of sense that I imagine Russian artists had, you know, around the time of the revolution, the few years when the empire was falling apart and before the Bolsheviks took over, when the old forms just would not do. And the previous generation of artists has sort of lost its credibility, and we are the next generation. You know, it's partly delusional, obviously, but we were young and we thought we can change this thing.
Mm. In the collection, The Question of Bruno, the longest story is an account of the experiences of someone whose the particulars of this character's life seem to track your own pretty closely, a fellow named Joseph Pronek, who comes to the United States and like you, and in a sense, ends up being marooned, has these various jobs, and tries to cope with adjusting to life in the United States. How much of that is your personal experience?
Well, in some ways, all of it and none of it, because no sequence of events in the story about Pronek echoes the sequence of events in my life. But the particular details or particular moments may have been part of my life. In other words, the fragments are mine, but the whole is Pronek's. And this is why people see it as close to my life. I mean, Pronek stories, they see it as close to my life. But it is a method of working, really. I mean, I don't want to abstract this from my experience or the experience of my life or anyone's life. But to transform your personal experiences into something that is beyond personal is what literature, to my mind, is all about. I mean, you have to start, and this is what when I'm talking to my students, I try to get this across, that you have to start from a personal place. But if you stay in a personal place, then it's not literature. It is, at best, the confessional memoir, which is really the most overrated genre or form in contemporary American literature.
Mm. Do you think that it says something beyond you think maybe you're trying to say something beyond your personal experience? Does this say something about the experience of anybody else coming to this country, or maybe just having that experience of going from some place which was their place, their culture, their history, to some place that was foreign, and what you end up going through dealing with the kind of culture shock that comes from making that transition.
I don't know if it Pranik is typical in that way, but Pranik's story opens up a space into which I would hope, and that's been the case based on what I heard from my readers, Bosnians or others, it opens up a space in which people can enter with their experiences and compare their experiences or find similarities and differences. The way I think of literature is that it opens up a public space for readers to enter. I delimit this space, you know, by the very fact that I wrote this book. And when people enter it, then we can talk about it. So I never thought of Pranik as typical. I believe in literary characters being particular, and this is what makes them universal. The fact that they are absolutely particular makes them universal in the sense that every human life is particular, and this is what's common in every human life, the particularity of it. So Pranik is not typical in that sense, but people have recognized themselves in Pranik. They also did not recognize themselves in Pranik. I mean, they're different instances. I am a Bosnian in the United States who was stranded by the war, but even in this relatively small realm of experiences, my experiences are not typical, because most of the Bosnians who live in Chicago, and Chicago has the greatest number of Bosnians in North America, Bosnian refugees, their experience is entirely different for a number of reasons. For one thing, neither Pranik nor I have been under siege or have been shot at. Whereas in Chicago, there's a large number of people who escaped the war. You know, they're running for their life, people who were in concentration camps and then were family members were killed and raped and so on. So it's an entirely different experience. There is something, however, to the situation of displacement, which is not necessarily related to war. I have taught, one of my many jobs was teaching English as a second language in a school where most of the students were from the former Soviet Union of Jewish background. And so they did not run away. They did not leave all their belongings behind necessarily. They were not shot at. Of course, they may have been exposed to some anti-Semitism, but it wasn't war. It wasn't, you know, total destruction of the infrastructure of their life. But I got along with them really, really well, because we found some common experiences, one of which, or the crux of which, would be the situation in which your previous life in some ways becomes unreal because it changes so much. I mean, your life changes so much when you arrive in the United States. It's also a situation which, and unfortunately a lot of Americans are prone to that, that people are judged by their ability to speak English, as if speaking English is the only way, the only language which you can express your mind. I had rocket scientists, literally, in my class when I was teaching English as a second language. And, you know, they were level two. They couldn't speak English well enough to talk about rocket science to, you know, their teachers who may have been just out of college. And often enough for them to feel uncomfortable, their teachers or people, native English speakers, would treat them with certain amount of condescension, that A, they couldn't really speak English, and B, you know, after decades of various forms of propaganda, the idea that people who have lived in socialism, in the Soviet Union, or whatever else, you know, devoid of democracy and free market, they're sort of half idiots, because you can be a full human being only if you grow up, you know, with all the amenities of free society. And so they felt detached by the fact of displacement, but also by the modes of engagement with America around them. They felt detached from their previous life. They, in some ways, they felt a need felt a need to validate a previous life, to have people see how legitimate it was. Because free market, no free market, you know, whatever the political system is, most of the human life is daily interactions with people around you. And to that extent, every life is legitimate. If you can lose it, it's legitimate.
Mm. Well, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Alexander Heyman. He is currently a visiting writer in the Creative Writing MFA program at U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. He now lives in Chicago, but as he has explained, and we have explained, he grew up in Sarajevo in Bosnia, came here in the early 90s, settled here in the United States, started to write, and now has published stories in various places, New Yorker, Esquire, Granta. He has a collection of stories, The Question of Bruno, and a novel, Nowhere Man. And he will be giving a reading this afternoon on the U of I campus at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4:30 in the Author's Corner. Questions are welcome, certainly, if you want to call in and talk. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The novel Nowhere Man takes this character that we have talked a little about, you have talked a bit about, Joseph Pronek, and tells us more about him and his life. Would you read a little something just so
sure.
Folks can get a sense of your writing and maybe a little bit more about who Joseph Pronek is?
I'll just read the beginning of his life. Hmm. He was born just like everyone else who has ever lived. So Joseph Pronek was born in the Sarajevo Maternity Hospital on September 10, 1967, after 37 hours of excruciating labor, the culmination of which was his mother's oath, as Joseph's little head was stuck between her legs halfway into the world, that she would strangle him with her own hands if he didn't come out immediately. His mother regretted her threat the moment she saw his crumpled face, dominated by a screaming mouth, like an expressionist painting. In her delirium, she found it extraordinarily beautiful.
Sure.
It was that very same expressionist face that was exhibited to Joseph's father, who was outside in the sunny hospital park, littered with drunken fathers. Pronek Sr. labored to stand straight, propped up by his friend Dushko, with whom he had celebrated his son's arrival into this woeful world. In a moment of peculiar inspiration, seeing his wrinkled, furious face, father compared Josef to the notorious Chombe, the man who killed Patrice Lumumba. Dushko, on the other hand, found the nascent Josef to resemble Mahatma Gandhi, perhaps because of a sheet of gauze wrapped across his mannequin chest. On little Josef's part, all he can remember, he still implausibly claims, from that day, the first in an as yet unconcluded sequence of days that constitute his life, was a frightening deluge of blazing light coming at him through the window pane as if the first thing he ever saw were a nuclear explosion.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what, just from the little bit that you've said about yourself and talked about writing, I don't know what sort of impression people get, but I think your writing has a wonderful sense of humor. I wouldn't want anybody to think that it was sort of dour, because it's not. Does it surprise you that somehow that people, you know, maybe expect one sort of thing and then they say, but gosh, it's really funny?
It doesn't surprise me. Well, you know, war is a dour thing. And it's also people expect stories of suffering. And there are stories of suffering in my books when books are related to war. But for a number of reasons, one of which is sort of the presence of the culture of victimhood in this country, where, you know, you sort of, one way to legitimize yourself either as an absolutely successful person or as a victim. You know, you ask people in the United States, how are you today? And then they say, oh, I'm really tired, as if, you know, somehow that makes the communication more serious. It has more weight if you talk to a tired person. And this is 9 a.m, mind you. So, but it's also that, a sort of dissociation of sensibilities, if you wish, dissociation of genres, that things are either funny or they're sad, right? You know, they have sitcoms that are always funny and never sad, and then you have whatever stories about struggling families, you know, and then there might be some epiphany at the end, but throughout it's just straight suffering. And people in whose cultures, I think, suffering is so fundamentally inscribed, they can't sustain just the stories of suffering. It's just, well, for one thing, it's damn boring. And secondly, it's unreal because people live through suffering and life includes all kinds of moments. So for whatever reason, you know, there are stereotypes about Jewish humor, and that's, you know, related to this similar sensibility or the ideas of similar sensibilities. But that's the case, I think, all across Eastern Europe from my experience. That, for instance, when I went back to Sarajevo for the first time after the war, this was in 97, and the war had ended in 95, late 95, people who hadn't seen me for a while, friends and family, they would tell me stories of war, which are really, you know, horrid stories about being under siege, not having food, all this. And more often than not, they would tell these stories as funny stories. We would roar with laughter, you know, over a story about how one family friend told me a story in which the whole family, neighbors, they all lived together in one apartment, 10, 12 of them, because it was easier for whatever reason for them to live together in someone else's apartment. I mean, some of the people there, their apartment had been destroyed and all this. And they didn't have food, and it was really hard, and it was winter. And so one day, one of them brings in a single potato, right? That's all they could find in the market. It was an extraordinary price. So they bring in a single potato. There's 12 of them. There's nothing they can do with a potato. They can't even divide it because it was probably half rotten. So what they did, because they hadn't seen a potato for such a long time, they actually put a potato in the middle of a table and then sat around the table looking at the potato. See, it's funny.
It's absurd.
It's funny.
It is funny. Yes.
It is funny. And this does not diminish the suffering of those people, particularly when they tell the story, because at some point, for one thing, suffering can reach the point of absurdity, which is funny. But it's also, when they were telling the story, they were announcing that they have survived, mm-hmm. and now they mm-hmm. can laugh over that. And so to insert humor into those situations, it's not only necessary, it's not to lighten it up so people can buy my book. It is inherent in the experience. Nabokov, talking about Chekhov, said that he wrote sad stories for humorous people, that you could understand the sadness of those stories only if you had a sense of humor. And this, to me, describes this sort of sensibility, which to me is Eastern European, or I recognize it primarily as Eastern European.
Over time, as you, and I'm not sure really how long it took you to feel comfortable writing in English, but over that time, do you think that your writing has changed as you got to the point where you felt that you had the kind of command of English that you wanted?
Well, I'm now perfectly comfortable. I write in my native language also, although it's mainly nonfiction. The division is really arbitrary. I have no reason not to write fiction in my native language, just turned out that way. I write regularly a column for a Bosnian magazine. I've been doing this now for 7 years or so, and have a book of columns out in Bosnia, and there'll probably be another one. It's 200,000 words in columns in my native language. So I'm just as comfortable writing in English as I am in my native language at this moment. For 3 years, from 92 to 95, I couldn't write in either language. Bosnian, I was severed from, because if language is related to the experience of the people who speak it, I was divorced from this experience because I was here and not under siege or in Bosnia. So I couldn't claim that language. And language changes under the pressure of experience. So it was changing in Bosnia. There were war-related words that, you know, I had to learn, which I had not been familiar with because, well, there was no war, or at least not in my lifetime. And obviously I couldn't write in English because, although I could speak English and communicate pretty well, when I arrived in the United States, I was far from being capable of writing in it. So from 92 to 95 or so, I couldn't write in either language, which is torment to me because writing had become a part of my life relatively early on, and I actually physically suffered from not being able to write. But for some reason or another, I started writing in English in 95, and the first story I wrote, which is entirely in English, is in The Question of Bruno. It's the Zorge aspiring. It's a story partly about Richard Zorge, the Soviet spy in Japan in World War II. And I wrote the story out of despair. It's a different story. In other words, I didn't think I was ready. I just had no choice but to try to write in English. And then I started writing it, and then I was surprised that, in fact, I could use the language in that way. There were literally moments when I would write a sentence using words, and I wasn't sure if they were right words. I would write a sentence, and then I would look up the words that I used in the sentence, and they were the right words. I had no idea how I knew them. They were completely absorbed. It was mainly through reading that I absorbed the language to write, as it's always the case, whether you write in your native language or not. So there was some struggle there, but on the other hand, it was far easier than I had expected it to be. I think this, from what I learned from this experience, from that experience, is that to be able to write in any language, native or not, that language has to be part of your subconsciousness. It has to enter into the subconscious. This happens to native speakers, you know, at the age of between 2 and 4. For whatever reason, the English language entered my subconscious between 92 and 95, between ages of 28 and 31.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. The number in Champaign-Urbana, by the way, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Again, our guest this morning is Alexander Heyman. He's visiting writer here at the University of Illinois in the graduate program in creative writing. He now lives in the United States, makes his home in Chicago, but as we have explained, he grew up in Bosnia, in Sarajevo. And came to the United States on an exchange program in the early 1990s, ended up staying, narrowly missed being in Sarajevo when the siege of the city broke out. He's now published a collection of stories, The Question of Bruno and his novel Nowhere Man, and they're both in print now and in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at them. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Champaign County here is our caller, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I hope this is not too unliterary and too sociological, but you did say that one of the short stories was about living and working, and it also stuck in my mind that you said Bosnia, and the largest concentration of Bosnians is in Chicago. I'm just wondering about that in some ways. It reminds me of the thing about Chicago where it's the third largest Polish population in the world, or the city with the third largest. I'm just wondering whether there's any sense that is there any remnant of Pan-Slavism, or is there just a cultural thing that it was the appropriate place to come to? Yugoslavia, after all, I guess I was surprised to hear Yugo just means south, so Yugoslavia was just South Slavia. And the other thing about working is that I know some Bosnians who had trouble with their papers, so I'm sure that perhaps one of the experiences would have been working without papers and consequently having all of the depredations of vulnerability that, you know, Mexican undocumented workers have here, and whether there was any interaction of that. And the only other thing I have to go, I'll listen off the air, is that the bit about humor, there's a film, and I don't know by what denomination the fellow was, but there's a film from generally the area called Underground, where the last scene is this, sticks in my mind so well, with the sort of continental drift where the land is actually separating and people are being separated. It's a
film by Emir Kusturica, who was Bosnian by birth, but at some point he decided he was Serbian. So it got politically complicated.
Is complicated. Well, there's a lot there, and I do have an appointment, so I have to go.
Thank you. As for Bosnians, I don't know if there's Pan-Slavism has been in some ways long dead. Yugoslavia means literally, but it implies a unity of South Slavs, which would be, you know, Serbs and Croats and Bosnians and Slovenians and Macedonians and so on. And that unity is over. I arrived to Chicago before other Bosnians because I happened to be just at the beginning of the war. I mean, the first day of the war, I was in Chicago. Most of the 40,000 Bosnians who are in Chicago now, most of them arrived in 94, started arriving in 94 and then thereafter. And this is the community that is now the largest in North America. So my experience was a little different in that sense. I mean, as far as papers, because when I applied for papers, they really had no official policy. The State Department and the Justice Department, they have to have an accepted policy, officially, unofficially, in relation to a particular group of people coming from a particular country. So I was an oddity at the time when I arrived. After that, the people who started arriving in 94 in Chicago, United States, were mainly people who were they were coming from a part of Bosnia that caught the world's headlines because of the large concentration of concentration camps run by Serbs. And many of those people, survivors of concentration camps, or just ran away from concentration camps. So they were brought over by relief agencies. So they actually, there was some infrastructure that met them here and, you know, helped them to some extent, whether they were helps learning English, or there was some work, or there was just financial support. At some point, of course, they started struggling. And there were people who started coming after this first wave brought in by relief agencies individually from Germany. In 97, I believe, Germany started getting rid of their Bosnians, about 500,000 or so. They started returning them. And a lot of people from Germany came to Chicago or the United States. So, to answer your question about the papers, I did work illegally, of course, but not for long, because I got my papers relatively quickly, for maybe 2 or 3 months, and I worked for less than minimum wage, which was $4.25 in 92. Mm. I worked for $4 an hour for some real estate agent who was packing it. He was packing his bags with money, and some of that money was mine. but I did some stupid data input for him for $4 an hour. His name was Johnny O, the real estate agent. So at some point I got a working permit and I started working legally, still for a little more than the minimum wage. The cultural shock for many immigrants, it's less recognizing the culture, being confused by TV. I mean, the culture, television culture and sort of American culture has been global for so long that, you know, the markers of this culture, the mainstream culture, are easily recognizable to almost everybody who comes here. What is shocking is really the situation, the labor situation, that you have to enter the labor market, you know, under certain circumstances, which are almost always humiliating. Working for minimum wage is inherently humiliating. You are, if you're working for minimum wage, you're exploited. It's that simple. And so people who may have come, even if they were unhappy in their former homelands, they were part of a family or some sort of community or some sort of infrastructure which made them feel relatively comfortable in their life. I mean, that's not necessarily the case, of course, but a lot of people I know, a lot of Russians, a lot of Bosnians, despite what may have happened in their lives, they had a memory of being comfortable and respected. And the situation of minimum wage work, it's inherently communicating. And this is something that you have to learn, to fill out the forms, to, you know, get a job, to abide by the rules of this. And then for Bosnians and Russians in particular, who, having lived in socialism, were used to the idea of permanent lifetime employment, to enter a working situation in which you can get fired next week and you are in, you know, a foreign land and your life depends on that wage. That's a scary, scary situation. I have always, whenever I worked, I was constantly being afraid. I was constantly afraid of being fired. So the shock really comes from immigration is less a cultural phenomenon than a labor phenomenon, economic phenomenon. The whole, you know, a lot of discussion in this country shifts from the economic issues to cultural issues. My identity, my culture is less relevant to me than my working situation once you arrive in the United States. The shock comes from having go to work. When I was looking for those low-wage jobs, I would go to interviews, you know, to work as a busboy or waiter in some minimum wage restaurant. And I would, you know, at this interview, I would tell them the story of my life. Oh, I used to be a journalist. I published stories, you know. It took me a few times, I'm slow, to figure out that this is not a good approach. If you want to be a busboy, you don't want to tell them that you have published articles in magazines. You know what I mean? They don't want someone organizing a union in their kitchen. They want someone who's helpless, so they can fire them and manipulate them and exploit them. And at some point, I started, you know, lowering my profile, as it were, when looking for those jobs.
So now you've been living in the United States now for 13 years?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Almost,
so,
yeah.
So have, at this point, have you managed to reestablish that kind of connection that you left behind, connection with family, with friends, with, you know, have you got that comfort?
Well, war is always destructive. You can never fully recover from war as a person or as a community or as a nation. It, no matter, even if you win it, and Bosnia did not win that war, really, even if you win it, from a personal point of view, something is destroyed, and you cannot recover that. The loss is irreversible. It's also related to this, but not necessarily the same thing, as a sort of a loss of displacement. Last year I was at a wedding in London. One of my two best friends was getting married in London. And at this wedding, there were about 30 people who I know from Sarajevo who came to the wedding. They came from Switzerland, they came from Montreal, they came from the United States, they came, I think there was one of them was from Australia, or came from Australia. If those people lived in the same place, Australia or Montreal or London, I would move to the place as of tomorrow. But there's no such place. There's no single place that can contain us. These are, you know, close friends. My family, I have family in Canada, in France, in Australia, in England, in Sweden, and, you know, in the United States, here and there. I have a cousin in New Caledonia. He was French-born, but so it's a different story. But I'm particularly proud of him. New Caledonia is way out. It's in the middle of the Pacific. So there's no... It's impossible to reconnect with that. But I have reconnected with friends, and it's much better than it used to be. I reconnected with friends. I'm in touch with them. My best friend, the one who lives in Montreal, one of the two, was in the war for, you know, throughout the war. He was under siege. He was in Bosnian army, and then he left Sarajevo in 97. So we were out of touch, more or less, except for occasional letters and satellite phone calls throughout the war. Now we are speaking, you know, daily almost, and have spending time together and all this. And also, which is important, I connected with Chicago. Chicago is my adopted hometown. Connected not in a very particular level. People I play soccer with, people, you know, my barber who's been cutting my hair for a decade now, so I can walk in and say, give me the usual, which is, you know, covering up my bald spot. And we discuss baseball and whatever. So that these sort of daily habits, that daily interactions that make someone feel at home in the city, I have managed to establish those routines, which to me are essential.
In that story, that story about Josip Broňák and Question of Bruno, when he meets and talks with Americans, one thing that seems to happen a lot is that people don't really quite understand where he's from. They can't quite place it, and can't quite hold on to the notion of where Sarajevo is and where Bosnia is and what Yugoslavia was and all that. And I'm sure that you had the same experience, that when people found out that you were from there, they asked you questions about the war. What was it about? And I'm sure that you heard lots and lots of this stuff that unfortunately I think Western media wrote over and over again. It's the ancient hatreds, you know, as if this was something that you couldn't really, an outsider really couldn't understand. There was no point even thinking about trying to intervene, and that it was something that had an almost inevitability about it, rather than understanding how the politics of the time really created what happened. Did you find yourself often trying to explain to people or being asked to explain what was happening?
I did, of course. And it's hard to explain, not because it's inexplicable, but because you have to, you know, qualify a lot of statements and explain the intricacy of it. And it's also people would, the way the questions were framed was this, you know, tell us about the thousands of years of hatred, because this was the stock response by the media. It was all over the New York Times and, you know, all these prestigious truth-telling media. It's also the way that the first Bush administration was trying to cover up the absence of the interest in the whole thing, and then Clinton too. So people, those were taglines picked up from the media that people approached. So sometimes I just had no energy to, you know, fight against the prejudices and ingrained responses to any sort of trouble outside of the United States. But there were also people who sincerely cared. Generally, they were just generally kind people, and there were quite a few of them, Americans. I don't think that Americans are congenitally or nationally incapable of understanding other human beings. To some extent, it's sort of brainwashing of capitalism and other things. So people who simply were able, with whom I was able to emotionally connect, I realized at some point that, well, if they don't know, they want to know, and we can talk about this. And this, of course, needed time. So to my friends, or people who would become my friends, and people who were capable of getting involved in whatever was my life at the time, and I was capable of getting involved in their life, over time, we could talk about this. But to explain to someone in 5 minutes, you know, what the situation was, they were so exhausting and tiresome, because more often than not, they just wanted the confirmation to what they had already thought. Mm. And, you know, at some point I started making up countries that I was from, because at some party, you know, it's party chit-chat, they want me to explain the war in Bosnia, in the middle of the war in Bosnia. So I would tell them I was from Luxembourg or whatever, Schnitzelland.
So just so you wouldn't have to, right, yeah. You wouldn't have to do it. Yeah. We have about 10 minutes. We have a caller, Ann Urbana. Let's talk with him. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Sort of got off the topic now because I was dialing the wrong number. You didn't say the number for a long time, and I was dialing 9544.
Oh, my apologies.
9455 or something. So what the topic was that sort of piqued my interest was your saying about being semi-displaced person and going to London and having 30 people there at a friend's wedding and they're all scattered. I just wanted to identify in a different way, although I'm Anglophone and live in America. I have lived in 7 countries and am the product of a colonial childhood and youth. I don't know where any of my friends are. I mean, they also went to Australia, Canada, South Africa. I would love to be able to get together in London with 30 friends, even, you know, to know where they were in the world. So there are some people who haven't gone through wars who also are... you know, in some similar state. And also, on the topic of your writing, I find it interesting that there seem to be a lot of writers, I happen to know of, a lot of writers coming out of Bosnia. You seem to be a very soulful and very literate people. And congratulations on your success, and
Thank
I look
you.
Forward to being able to read your book.
Thank you. I think it's very interesting what you said because, you know, in some ways the fundamental fact of the world today is migration. It's the masses of people moving. Parts of those masses are moving or being moved by war and various trouble. But even beyond that, there are so many people crossing borders and moving from one country to another that it really, I don't think there's a cultural precedent for that. Even the you know, the Ellis Island immigrants are another precedent, because those people who came in, first of all, half of them went back after 10 years or so. I don't know if it's half, but a large percentage, they completely erased from the, you know, the mythology of the American dream. People would come in and make money and work for 10 years and then go back and buy a piece of land in their homeland. My best friend's, the one who was actually getting married in London, his grandfather was a hotel detective in Chicago for 10 years, and then he went back to Bosnia and bought a useless piece of land, which is a different story. But also those who stayed here, right, because that was the technology of the day, the situation of the day. People would go back after 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years once or twice, right? They would write letters that would travel for months. They would go back after 50 years to whatever, to Sicily, say, and find an empty village, right?
I was going to say, it's never the same. There's no going back.
Right.
There is no there that you knew. It's just like when you came here, it would be the same. So, you know, I actually envy you, ironically, because there is a community here of people from your land. And I find that of a lot of non-Anglophone immigrants have a community of their own nationals. If you're Anglophone, you don't. You're supposed to just be American. I ain't American. I'll never be American. Anyway, I'm very interested. I'll hang up.
Right. Thank you. But the world today is different because people who come in this country today, they, you know, the phone calls are relatively cheap. The internet, I write a column for Magazine Sarajevo, which I email a couple of times a month, and people read me there, and not only there, but those Bosnians who are in Australia and my friends I met at the wedding who live in Zurich and whatever, they read this. The plane flights are relatively cheap. People stay in touch. If there's assimilation, it works entirely differently. And this is not just the United States. It's all over the world. And, you know, this is partly why sustaining a community is not as hard as it used to be. Assimilation works entirely differently. And this is going to change. It is changing American culture. One of the consequences is sort of the hardening of American nationalism. People who are ranting against foreigners and afraid of them openly or, you know, insidiously, as this administration is insidiously stoking xenophobia in this country. So, you know, society is changing both ways because of the modes of immigration these days. As for the soulful people of Bosnia, we are soulful unless we were criminals.
You've said something that I think is really interesting, and that is about this idea that the nature of assimilation is changing. That it's not like what it was. And as you say, it's true that I think a lot of Americans react to this with fear about the way in which the country is changing. And some people somehow have this idea that what it means to be an American, whatever that is being lost. And that if we have a nation where substantial numbers of people have a sense of dual citizenship, that somehow that means their identification with this country and its values are not as strong as if that tie was effectively broken when they came. And I'm interested in what you think about where it is we're going here in the United States and what the nature of this new kind of assimilation is and whether, in fact, it is possible to maintain a strong sense of dual identity that one can be an American citizen and part of this country and yet still feel that very strong connection with the place that you come from.
Well, it's going in several possible directions, maybe simultaneously. One of the directions is sort of the hardening of nationalism, which is, you know, getting closer to fascism. And you can see this in the current administration, which is stoking and exploiting and depending on the sort of American nationalism and fearing the other. But at the same time, it's irreversible, you know. I mean, the Spanish-speaking people in this country, they are not going away. I mean, no matter what they do, they're not going to go away. They're going to be here and they're going to change this country. And whatever the administration does, whatever the fascists do, they're going to stay. So simultaneously, there's going to be the hardening of hardliners, and, you know, a transformation of society, which at one point or another, to this or that extent, is going to lead to conflict. But the ideal outcome of this would be a transformation of the society, American society, which, and the American identity, which would not depend so much on the sort of set of essential characteristics, the sort of the mythology of what it means to be American, which is somehow what every American has inside, and whether it's, you know, believing the founding fathers and freedom, whatever the mythology is, I don't have to tell you this. And the society could move toward a more democratic society where people will form a community based not on their identity or national identity or ethnic identity, but based on their sort of common interests. There is no conflict between me being Bosnian and me being American. If I live in this country with other Americans and we find a common political interest, which we are willing to negotiate with other group of people who has another common interest, and then we both of those groups and many other groups invest in their time and energy and love and money and whatever into living in this society, you know, that would lead toward more democracy. But then you have the situation which America as it is today and capitalism as it is today is running into the concept of democracy. Democracy as it has been, American democracy, cannot really deal with this. And what we have is a crisis of democracy, as evident in the current situation.
Well, we'll have to stop there. If you're interested in reading some of Alexander Heyman's writing, again, there's a collection of stories, The Question of Bruno, and his novel Nowhere Man. He'll be doing a reading this afternoon on the U of I campus at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner at 4:30 this semester. Alexander Heyman is a visiting professor in the Creative Writing MFA program at University of Illinois, recently named a MacArthur Fellow. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. The broadcast today is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Focus also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up in the next hour, Focus 580, we'll be inviting your health care questions. Our guest will be Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he is here on the show to answer questions. He deals with people of all ages in his practice. So if you have concerns for yourself or someone in your family, you're certainly welcome to call. We'll have news from International Public Radio 1 minute past the hour. First, though, an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
And with this update on the markets at coming up on 10:59, I'm Jay Pierce. Well, let's take a look at the Chicago Board of Trade first. The wheat contract